Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Back to Catholic Answers Live. Weird questions for Jimmy Akin this hour, and we've got lots of weird questions here. Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book and A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and many other things. And perhaps most pertinently for this hour, to encourage you to hang around and listen to the answers, Jimmy is the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which is one of the most popular documentary podcasts in this country. And around the world, people listen. And more than 350 mysteries there that you can check out at mysterious.fm. But you don't have to go there at the moment, because right now we've got Jimmy to answer weird questions. Welcome back, Jimmy. Thanks for being here again.
Howdy, Si.
Shall we just let the weirdness continue, Jimmy? Get right back to what the internet has proposed to you?
What would you do if I said no?
I would be like, well, I'll read an ad, maybe vamp for a while. I don't know. I don't know what I would do. I'm just guessing.
Okay. Well, then why don't we get back to it?
All right. This one's from Rebecca Lynn. I read or heard somewhere years ago that the mark of the beast is your intellect, head, and will, hand, given over to the devil. Any truth to this? It makes sense to me because it would be an inversion of marking yourself with the sign of the cross and its meaning that you do all through and for Christ. And that's what the devil does, right? He turns everything on its head.
Well, I think there's a substantial amount of truth there. Of course, we read in the book of Revelation that the mark of the beast is put either on a person's forehead or on their right hand. Now, the hand is the easy part because most people are right-handed, and so the right hand is what most people do stuff with. What's a little harder is the mark on the forehead. And today I've even said similar things to this in the past, but I'm going to give a tweak now that I think is important. It's not clear how the Hebrew author John would have been conceptualized in the role of the head, because the idea that we have, that the brain is the seat of thought, is not what many in the ancient world had. Instead, they tended to think of your heart, the physical organ, your heart, as the seat of thought. One of the reasons for that is because there is a correlation between what your heart's doing and your experience. So, for example, if you are in a lot of danger, you know, your heart starts racing. Now, we understand the reason for that is it's pumping blood so that your tissues are fully oxygenated and you can respond to the danger. Similarly, if you're really impressed with someone, like let's say you're falling in love with someone, your heart might skip a beat. And so there is a correlation between what your heart's doing and your circumstances. And so they tended to say, okay, well, you know, the heart is obviously an important organ. If you injure someone's heart, they're going to die. And there's this correlation with their experience. And so a lot of people in the ancient world, including the ancient Hebrews, tended to think of the heart as where consciousness was primarily located. That's why, for example, you'll be reading the Bible and it'll say things like, so-and-so said in his heart, or so-and-so thought in his heart. That's because of how they conceptualized these matters. They thought of the heart as the primary seat of consciousness. Now, that wasn't the only idea. There were other ideas. And I know that as early as the 5th century BC, so this is the BC 400s, there was a Greek thinker who proposed that the head and the brain might be the seat of consciousness. Some people, incidentally, in the ancient world, I mean, so what did they think the brain was for if they didn't think it was for thinking? Well, some of them thought it was for keeping your skull from collapsing. So it's just kind of a filler organ.
Well, that's useful.
But yeah, but there were some who speculated that it might be the brain that's the seat of consciousness. However, that idea really didn't seem to fully catch on until the 2nd century AD, when it was proposed by the Greek physician Galen that the ventricles in the brain might be responsible for complex thought. So because John's living in this middle period and he's coming from a culture that tended to focus on the heart rather than the head as the seat of consciousness, it's not clear to me that we can just say the head represents the intellect. Now, that doesn't mean that they didn't regard the head as important. They did regard heads as important in the ancient world. For example, when God's promise in Israel that if they obey him, things are going to go well, he tells them things like, you're going to be the head and not the tail. And so they recognize like the head of an animal is more important than the tail of an animal. And one thing we do know about foreheads in particular in the ancient world is that they would sometimes mark them. If someone was a slave or the devotee of a particular god, so if someone's a slave, they could mark your master's name on your forehead. Or if someone was a worshiper of a particular god, they might write the god's name on your forehead. And so this was a way of advertising who you serve. And so even though they may not specifically have the thought of intellect being associated with the head, I think we get to the same basic conclusion in a roundabout way of this shows who you serve. If you're serving the beast, you're either going to be serving him, you're advertising your service with the image of the mark being written on your forehead. That's a mark of your service to the beast. And having the mark on your hand would mean you serve the beast with your hand. So I think we get to the same conclusion of you're serving the beast body and soul, or your entire being is serving the beast. But I think we may need to take a little bit of a nuance when it comes to exactly how does intellect play a role in this imagery.
Rebecca Lynn, thank you very much for starting us off with that interesting question. This next one, Jimmy, comes from Lost Archivist, who we have heard from a couple times lately. I don't know why that name, it just sticks in my head, so I know that. Lost Archivist says, I've got one. Let's say someone has a vision and they're having a hard time understanding and remember it after many years. Or we have an old vision by a saint that was not well understood what the meaning was. Would feeding the writings the person wrote on it into an AI like ChatGPT be a viable method for better understanding it? Or is this more likely to muddy the waters even more? What are the potential benefits and dangers of this practice?
Well, if we have a lot of writings from a particular saint, let's say, that could shed light on the meaning of the vision the saint had, then there would be nothing wrong with using an AI to index those writings and surface passages that scholars could look at for, you know, could this help us interpret this vision? But if we don't have something like that, If the saint just wrote something and it's unclear, and we don't have a lot of other stuff that he wrote that could shed light on it, then asking the AI to reconstruct what did this mean, I think would be a mistake, because AIs, at least at present, have, you know, these large language models like ChatGPT, they have a tendency to hallucinate. And so if you ask it, you know, give me 5 papers on topic X, and it doesn't know 5 papers on topic X, it'll make them up. And that's called AI hallucination.
Oh, man.
And so what these large language models are designed to do is not be super accurate, but to please the human user. And so if they think, oh, well, he's asked for this, I'll just make something up and give it to him and he'll be happy, then that's what they do. So they while one day they may be of greater use to scholarship, they are not there now. And so I wouldn't be using AIs to try to reconstruct or give us any kind of scholarly interpretation of what somebody perceived in a vision and what it means.
All right, Lost Archivist, thank you for the question. That brings us to the break. Right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Beyond Damascus with Dan Demite and Aaron Richards is our show for young adults.
Everybody's talking about encounter. Everybody's talking about that mountaintop experience. What we fail to often talk about is what happens after. What happens beyond that Damascus moment?
Jesus Christ is calling all of us to be missionary disciples, disciples of Jesus who are on mission to bring the kingdom of God here and now on this earth.
Beyond Damascus with Dan Demite and Aaron Richards, tomorrow at 8 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin here with us, proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, one of the most popular podcasts, one of the most popular documentary podcasts out there. Check it out at mysterious.fm. And we've got weird questions for Jimmy. And this one comes from user and then a long user number. Imagine that there is a chart meant to represent how authoritative and well-documented a particular church teaching is, with the extremes of superstition, sometimes repeated by clergy, and infallible dogma on either side, on either end of an x-axis, and rarely mentioned except in connection with some other issue, and volumes of ink spilled on this topic on either end of the y-axis. Where would you place, oh my goodness, where would you place the following two topics on that chart? And if they're high on the y-axis, what are the documents I could find on them to research further? For if you're not a visual thinker, God bless you for what we just did. But I'll try to
make it clear.
Imagine that x and y-axis from your algebra class. Soul ties is the first one. And then multi-generational curses placed on Catholic descendants of Freemasons by their ancestors and the right way to avoid ill effects of them if they exist.
Okay, so let's start with the chart that user number has proposed. The x-axis, for people who may not remember from high school, is the horizontal one. So it's the one that goes left to right. And the y-axis is the one that goes top to bottom. It's the vertical axis. So on one end, let's say the left-hand end of the horizontal or x-axis, we've got superstition sometimes repeated by clergy. And then as you gain greater degrees of authority of church teaching until you get to the right-hand end of the x-axis, which is infallible dogma. Then on the vertical axis, we've got rarely mentioned except in so that deals with the level of authority is what the horizontal axis does. The what the y-axis does, the vertical axis, is it deals with how commonly it's discussed. So down at the bottom, you've got rarely discussed except in connection with another issue. And then way at the top of the vertical axis, you've got volumes upon volumes of ink spilled on this topic. Okay, so with that as the framework, the user wants to know, where would I put soul ties as his first subject? Okay, soul ties is not a church teaching. You will not, you can look in papal encyclicals, you can look in conciliar documents, you can look in the catechism, you are not going to run into soul ties. So this is on the speculative end of things. But then we've got to say, well, okay, so what type of ties are we talking about? If you look at those people who do, priests and stuff, who do talk about soul ties, they'll define them frequently in terms of alliances. So they'll say, you know, when we have an alliance with somebody, it's we're tied to them. And it's either a positive alliance or a negative alliance. And sometimes they will say things like, well, let me give some examples. You know, if two people get married, they're obviously tied to each other. If two people are friends, they're obviously tied to each other. If two people have a business partnership, or if they've signed a contract to do business together, they're tied to each other. So so there is some validity to this concept, but it seems that the people who are into this are taking it a little further than that. They're not just claiming that ties exist between people. That's obvious. But they're claiming that a certain type of tie can exist that can be unhelpful and that can be helped, for example, by praying over it. So you could release someone from a soul tie by praying over it. Well, that doesn't apply to a lot of the types I just mentioned. Two people are married, they aren't unmarried just because you pray over it. If two people have a business partnership, they signed a contract, that contract does not become null and void because you pray over it. If two people are friends, well, you can pray, but that's not what's going to cause them to not be friends anymore. That involves voluntary choices they'd have to make to say, I don't want to be friends with this person anymore. So the idea that there's some additional type, like I saw, for example, one person on a website was saying, I'm having trouble with my baby mama, who I've been trying to break, you know, get her out of my life, but she doesn't want to get out of my life. And my confessor told me I have a soul tie and I need to make an appointment with him to pray about it and be released from this soul tie to my baby mama. Okay, so this is some mystical soul tie that you have to this woman. There is no evidence for that. This is, the church does not have a category for this, and especially not one that can be helped by prayer. Now, you can pray about anything you want, but it seems to me that here we're in a territory that has a high risk of superstition, that more is being attributed to the soul tie than maybe she doesn't want to get out of your life because she doesn't want to get out of your life. It's not a mystical soul tie. It's just she's deriving some benefit from being in your life. She wants to stay there. And so there's a risk of attributing too much significance, which is what superstition is, either to the idea of some kind of mystical tie or to the efficacy of prayer in dealing with it, where really what you need to do is say, get out of my life and I'm shutting the door and you can't have access beyond this point. You don't, prayer doesn't enter into it. So I would say while there's some validity in this area, there is also a high risk of superstition. Now, the second issue that the user asks about is multi-generational curses placed on Catholic descendants of Freemasons by their ancestors and the right way to avoid ill effects from them if they exist. Okay. Oh, and by the way, I forgot, on the y-axis for soul ties, it's down at the bottom. These are almost never mentioned. They are occasionally mentioned by fringe authors on websites, and that's about it. But you won't find them like if you go reading in Thomas Aquinas or something like that. So multi-generational curses, especially those connected with Freemasons. Well, there are a couple of problems here. The first one is how did these curses get in place? Because when you become a Freemason, and you shouldn't, but when you become a Freemason, you do take oaths. And those oaths can involve imprecations on yourself, like if I ever betray the secrets of Freemasonry, may my tongue be cut out or whatever. But I've gone looking for ones involving one's descendants, and I haven't found them. You know, it's not like if I ever betray, by becoming a Freemason, I want all my descendants cursed. You know, that's not an oath in Freemasonry. There, when the oaths and the imprecations come in Freemasonry, it's like if you betray them. But just by becoming a Freemason, it's not like I hereby curse my descendants. And the absence of any such curses in Freemasonry seems confirmed by what I've read from some anti-Freemasonic authors who say things like, by becoming a Freemason, people curse themselves and their descendants knowingly or unknowingly. Well, that's a hint that if it happens at all, it's unknowingly, because they don't really take curses. They don't really make curses on their descendants. But that brings us to another problem, which is, as they say at the intellectual climax of The Princess Bride, if you didn't say it, you didn't do it. You know, you don't, if you, in a marriage, unless you exchange consent, you're not married. So the same thing is true with curses. Unless you literally curse someone, they are not cursed. Okay. So unless I say, I want all my descendants to have the following ill effects, then you have not cursed your descendants with those ill effects. So you didn't say it, you didn't do it, and to me it looks like Freemasons are not doing this. So this, on count one, seems to be superstition being repeated by some clergy. Unless you can produce a document where Freemasons invoke a curse that's actually a curse on their descendants, this appears to be superstitious rumor mongering. That's point one. Point two is that the Catholic Church does not teach the existence of the ability. This deals with the efficacy of such curses. The Catholic Church does not teach that humans can efficaciously put curses on other humans. And in fact, if you read the 1998 Rite of Exorcism, which exorcists ought to have read, it specifically warns that the exorcist needs to distinguish cases of demonic involvement from that credulity with which some people, even the faithful, think that they are the victim of evil doing, which means black magic or bad luck or a curse put on them by others. So the church's official document here, this is an official liturgical document of the Catholic Church and thus reflects Catholic principles, theologically speaking, and Catholic doctrine, warns people not to give credulity to such claims. And so that's reason number two. This is superstition, sometimes repeated by clergy. So not only does there not appear to be a foundation in Masonic documents for the idea that people are cursing their descendants when they become Freemasons, but even the efficacy of curses themselves is rejected by the church's official documents. So this, I would have to say, is superstition repeated by clergy. So that's its x-axis assignment. What about its y-axis assignment? Well, once again, this is way down at the bottom. This is not something you are not going to find discussions of humans putting curses on other humans in magisterial documents. Like, you know, it's not going to be in Vatican II. It's not going to be in Vatican I. It's not going to be in the Council of Trent. It's not going to be in papal encyclicals. It's not going to be in the Catechism. This is, again, a fringe. It's not even going to be in classic authors like Aquinas. You know, if you look in the Summa Theologia, he's got a section on cursing, but he's talking about bad language and using curses not in an efficacious sense to curse other human beings by some mystical power. So this is a minor topic that is typically discussed only by fringe authors.
There you go. Thank you for the XY axes there. It was not only a weird question, but a fascinatingly constructed one. Thank you. This one comes from Western Man of the Plains. I assume that name is related to Fighting Man of the Plains, the movie. Is there any DNA evidence pointing towards Noah and his family? Excuse me for my ignorance if you have talked about this already. I'm new to your channel.
Well, the answer is no. We do have evidence of population bottlenecks, to use the technical term for them, where the human population shrank dramatically at some point in the past due to one or another factor, like, you know, environmental problems or lack of food resources or a huge volcanic explosion wiped out a bunch of people. We can look at the genetic history of the human race and spot population bottlenecks. And there have been a couple that where we really got down to a very small number of humans, like 1,000 or something. But we don't have anywhere it went down to 8 people. And so there's no DNA evidence for Noah and his family. Now, that doesn't mean that Noah and his family didn't exist, but what it would suggest is, at a minimum, that the flood was not a global one. And so it could have been a local flood that wiped out life in a significant chunk of the earth, but not the whole thing. And there were other humans surviving in other parts of the world.
Western Man of the Plains, thank you for the question. Lots more weird questions to come for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
Is Orthodoxy an alternative to the Catholic Church? In a time of uncertainty for many Catholics, Orthodoxy can look like greener pastures. Answering Orthodoxy, the new book from Catholic Answers Press, explains why Catholics who are thinking of leaving need to think twice. There are important reasons to remain in the Catholic Church and convincing answers to Orthodox claims. Order your copy of Answering Orthodoxy today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Deepen your connection to the Church's holy days and seasons while you draw on the wisdom of the Church Fathers. Feasts of Our Fathers, the new book from Mike Aquilina and Adam Lucas, is a treasury of history, prayers, insights, and lessons that will bring you closer to the earliest of Catholic traditions. Take your prayer life and your solidarity with the Church, past and present, to a new level. Order your copy of Feasts of Our Fathers today at shop.catholic.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Having fun with Jimmy Akin. It's weird questions for Jimmy Akin this hour on Catholic Answers Live, and lots of weird questions have come in. Up next, this is a question from Nocturne 2029. Are you aware of any instances of souls in purgatory manifesting within another person? For context, the newest episode of The Exorcist Files included a case where a soul in purgatory manifested in a demoniac to aid the exorcist by shedding light on the reason for the demonic infestation, which seems perfectly within God's powers to permit.
Okay, so we need to split this question in two. One is, can a soul in purgatory manifest in another person in any situation outside of an exorcism? And the second is, can they manifest in a person during an exorcistic situation like is reported here? When it comes to the latter, I don't have a firm opinion on the matter. I would say we have to look at the experiences that people report and see what is reported and try to make a determination of, are they credible? So if I were looking at a whole bunch of exorcism cases, and in some of them, a personality manifested that claimed to be a soul in purgatory and claimed to be on the exorcist side and provided paranormal information that, you know, veridical information that turned out to be true that nobody knew, then, and was genuinely being helpful, well, okay, the fact that the personality is giving us veridical information that nobody knew, that's a sign that that's at least evident, doesn't prove it, but it's at least evidence that this personality is a spirit, and as opposed to, you know, imagination or something like that. And if it's being genuinely helpful to the exorcist, then that's prima facie evidence that it's not a demon or a damned soul, neither one of which you would expect to be helpful. So and if it says I'm paying off my sins, I'm doing atonement for what I did wrong. I mean, I've been forgiven, but I'm doing atonement for what I did wrong as part of purgatory. If it's otherwise helpful, well, then you'd have a reasonable evidential basis for saying, okay, that's what was going on here. And then it would be a question of how common is this phenomenon. Now, there's no proof in this area, because it could be that this is really imagination and it was the person's psychic powers that came up with the information. Or it could be it really is a spirit and it's a demon and it was lying about being from purgatory and it was lying about being helpful. That's also possible. So you can't prove anything in these areas, but what you can do is make a reasonable assessment based on what the evidence looks like and what it seems to support, but you always got to leave it as a provisional judgment, which is true with exorcism in general. There are comparatively few cases where you can really prove that something was a demon. You may be able to prove something paranormal was going on, but you always got to be somewhat cautious in arriving at conclusions. So that deals with the exorcism situation. I'd say it's an empirical question. What do the case histories report, and how credible are the case histories when you examine them? What about outside of an exorcistic situation? Could there be a soul in purgatory manifesting through someone in other ways? Well, okay, that would go to the ability of humans to manifest in other people. And for reasons I won't go into, we actually have some fairly good evidence that suggests that is possible under at least certain circumstances. Apparitions are a case where a spirit manifests to a person, and then that person is able to, for example, say, well, here's what the apparition is saying. But we even have some evidence that an apparition can manifest through a person. And so it takes us too far afield to go into all of that. But I am aware of one case where it looked like this happened with soul in purgatory. Father Alois Weisinger discusses this in his book on paranormal phenomena and Catholic teaching. And it was an incident that occurred, I believe, in the 1930s, although I could have that wrong, in Italy, where you had a young girl, and I think her mother, go into a gathering in town. And as they're passing this particular bridge, all of a sudden the girl falls down unconscious. And when she wakes up, she's not identifying as the girl anymore. She's identifying as like a 30-year-old man who, it turns out, was a real guy that had lived in the town and had died at that bridge a number of years before. And she's talking as if she is this guy. And what she reveals is that the guy, people had thought the guy had committed suicide by jumping off the bridge. But what he's actually saying is, no, it was not suicide. I was murdered by my friends, and here are their names. And so this looked like a purgatorial ghost who is trying to get justice because what they did was they threw him off the bridge and they may have bludgeoned him, and then they made it look like a suicide when really it was murder. And so this looks like a purgatorial ghost that's trying to get justice for what was done. And then when the mother of the dead man asked the spirit to leave the girl, it did. It had delivered its message and it left. And so all of that's consistent. I mean, it's at least suggestive of, you know, what you would expect a soul in purgatory might do. It's not behaving like a demon. It's not behaving like a saint appearing from glory. It looks like, you know, it's a purgatorial ghost. And Father Weisinger, who was an early 20th century Catholic parapsychologist, was open to it was the only case like this he was aware of, but he was open to the possibility that that's what it was. And so I'd say I'm open to it too. I'd have to see more cases of this to see if it's an establishable phenomenon, but it is something that is at least reported in the literature.
All righty. Thank you very much for the question. Lots and lots of weird questions. That one came from a Nocturne 2029. Weird questions for Jimmy Akin. If you'd like to get your questions into us, you can always send a question to radio@catholic.com, our email address, or just get it to Jimmy through one of his various social media outlets. This one comes from Elizabeth. If there's a zombie apocalypse or a nuclear war, well, those are pretty different, Elizabeth. If there's a zombie apocalypse or a nuclear war, should a believer...
What if a nuclear war leads to a zombie apocalypse?
Oh, yeah, by irradiating... I think it's much more likely to lead to the emergence of a monster like Godzilla. I'm just saying. Okay. I mean, I'm talking science now. You know, I'm a pretty good scientist. If there's a zombie apocalypse or nuclear war, should a believer go to an adoration chapel and watch over Jesus, or attempt to move him to a safer location, if possible?
Well, I would say if possible, yeah, that would be a praiseworthy thing to do. Now, you're going to have to find a safer place, you know, and that could be challenging, especially in the case of a zombie apocalypse, since the zombies are a mobile threat. In the case of a nuclear war, you know, you don't know where the bombs are going to fall. So that also would be a problem. But if you can identify a safer place to repose the Eucharist, then moving the Eucharist to that location would be a praiseworthy thing to do. It probably wouldn't fall on the laity in the first place, though. Instead, it would fall on the priests of the parish, or, you know, deacons or somebody like that. But if they've all been killed or turned into zombies, you know, then it could fall on a layperson to do that. Another possibility is that one could consume the Eucharist, so that, which is its ultimate destiny anyway. You know, you don't consecrate a host and keep it around forever. Its reservation in the tabernacle is only a temporary thing until it's to be consumed. So its ultimate destiny is to be consumed anyway. And if you're in a sufficiently grave emergency and you don't have a safe place to transfer the Eucharist to, then you could consume the Eucharist in order to have a reverent disposition of the Eucharist rather than leave it in place to be desecrated by zombies or nuclear war.
Elizabeth, thank you very much for the question. That'll take us to a break. We'll be right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives. The year is 2016. EWTN News inaugurates the Vatican Bureau in Rome, where St. Peter's Basilica sets the backdrop. The occasion sparked reflection on Mother Angelica's legacy and the media network's mission to serve the gospel.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Weird questions for Jimmy Akin this hour, and we have lots of weird questions. We've gone through lots of weird questions and quite a few more to come. This one comes from somebody named, and I use the phrase named loosely, PX2762. PX asks, if a woman gains DNA permanently from the children she has, does that mean a relic of St. Anne is also a possible relic of the Blessed Virgin Mary?
Okay, so the way this happens is through a process known as microchimerism. A chimera is a creature from Greek mythology that is a composite of different creatures. So like it could have the head of a lion and the wings of an eagle and the body of an ox, let's say. So it's a composite of different animals. And it's turned out that the same thing happens in humans on a cellular level. So one way microchimerism can happen in humans is if you have twins in the womb and something goes wrong in their development so that one twin eats the other and the second twin's cells get merged in amongst the cells of the first twin, and then the person grows up and has no idea that they're bodily cells came from two different original twins, and so some of their cells have one genetic code and other of their cells have another genetic code. But notice it's on the cellular level that the mix-in happens. So it's not like one cell has both genetic codes. It's different cells have different genetic codes. So it's not a genetic fusion. It's a chimerism or combination of cells that have different genetic sources. Well, the same thing happens in ordinary pregnancies with women in that while the baby is in the womb, some of the child's cells enter the woman's body and remain there and continue to endure after the pregnancy is over. So this is maternal microchimerism. It's a very small number of cells, but they do, science has reported, enter the mother's body and remain there. But notice this is happening on the cellular level. It's not like her own cells acquire DNA from the child. Instead, in addition to her own cells, she has cells that came from the child and have the child's DNA. And so what that means is if you had a relic of St. Anne, in order for it to contain a genetic relic of the Virgin Mary, it would have to have some of the Virgin Mary's cells in it. But where are those cells going to go? As far as I'm aware, they stay in the reproductive tract. So if you had, say, the hand of St. Anne or a little bone fragment of St. Anne, then it wouldn't have any of the Virgin Mary's cells in it. And so it would be just a relic of St. Anne. It wouldn't have any of the microchimeric cells from the Virgin Mary unless you had the reproductive tract of St. Anne. And I don't know that anybody has any authenticated relics of St. Anne, but they would not have genetic relics of the Virgin Mary unless they somehow had cells from the Virgin Mary in that relic.
PX, thanks for that question. Getting near the end, so on we go. Rebecca Lynn asks this. Would it be sinful to actively participate in an ayahuasca ceremony, either for therapeutic reasons or pure curiosity, with a sitter but without a shaman? Also, I've heard that being inebriated or hypnotized can open you up to demonic influence. Do you believe this is true, even if the person is normally opposed to anything sinful and freely chooses to enter this state with no intention of anything sinful?
Okay, so we have a number of concepts on the table here. The first one that we ought to mention is what ayahuasca is, because a lot of people are not familiar with it. Ayahuasca is a compound made out of, it's typically served in liquid form, and it's a compound made of various plants that grow in Latin America. It's used, it's a hallucinogen, and it takes effect very rapidly, supposedly. And people have very short, intense hallucinatory experiences. It has been traditionally used as part of, folk religion in parts of certain parts of Latin America. And it's become popular with some Westerners recently. Well, okay, so Rebecca Lynn asks, could you do it for therapeutic reasons or out of curiosity? Well, if it has a therapeutic effect, which is something that's currently, I guess, being investigated, and if you have a condition that it can successfully treat, then it would be like taking any other medicine. So you could take ayahuasca if it turned out that it has a therapeutic effect on a condition you've got, and there's not a better alternative, just like any other drug you could take. What about for curiosity? Well, I think that's more delicate, because there's nothing wrong with wanting to understand what an experience is like, but there are costs and benefits to having an experience. And one of the potential costs is you could have a bad trip, because people do have bad trips on ayahuasca. Also, since it's a hallucinatory experience, you could come back with ideas that you're going to give too much credence to and not properly discount them as, okay, that was wild, but that was just a hallucination. And that's on the assumption that it's purely hallucinatory and you're not really in contact, for example, with machine elves, or which are a kind of entity that people sometimes report on ayahuasca. There could be detrimental effects to pursuing curiosity about this experience. Then, supposing there are machine elves, supposing that's real, and by contacting them, anytime you contact someone, you're open to influence by that person. And they don't have to be a demon to be a bad influence. They could, and having contact with someone when you are literally out of your mind is not necessarily the best idea. So I would say I can't altogether rule out the curiosity thing, but I would say I would want more information about all this that I don't think we yet have before I could be confident trying it out just to see what it's like. I want something proved safe before, in all senses of the word safe, before I would try something like this. So I'm not an advocate of experimenting with this stuff. Then Rebecca Lynn says that she's heard that being inebriated, so let's just stick with alcohol for that, or hypnotized can open you up to demonic influence. Well, anything can open you up to demons. This is people talk about, ooh, this will open you up to demons as a way of scaring people off. But mere possibility. I mean, you could go down to, you could go down to the parish library in your parish and pick up a Bible. And it could be that a demon is infesting that Bible. And by opening the Bible, you're opening yourself up to demons, to influence by demons. Well, that's possible, but how likely is it? It's not very likely, in particular because demons are averse to the holy. That's one of their characteristics. They would not find it enjoyable infesting a Bible. That's not to say it can't happen, but it's not probable. And so what you need to do is have a realistic risk assessment. We are not called in this life to avoid all risk. We are called to manage risk. And so let's look at alcohol. Someone gets inebriated on alcohol. How often are they under any kind of notable demonic influence? That's very rare. So I'm not advocating drunkenness, but I am advocating realism that if you get drunk, you're not likely to experience significant demonic oppression. That's just a very low order of risk. What about hypnotism? Well, actually, the Catholic Church has documents dealing with hypnotism that go back to at least Pius XII, maybe earlier than that. I'd have to check. Where they've said, okay, if you're using hypnotism for a legitimate purpose, like, you know, pain control or something, and you're excluding all this, any spiritism from it, then it's perfectly fine. And so, in the Catholic Church's view, it's, as long as you're not using it for some weird, we're going to contact spirits while you're hypnotized, it's okay. And they didn't say, oh, but you're opening yourself up to demons, because they didn't see that as a notable risk. Well, like I said, anything can, quote unquote, open you to demons, but the vast majority of things won't. And therefore, you need to be realistic. And the church has not deemed it appropriate either for alcohol or for hypnosis to warn people that they may be opening themselves up to demonic influence. You will not find that in the catechism. You will not find that in papal documents. You will not find that in conciliar documents. That is attributed too much significance to demons and the odds of their influence. And thus, I would say that is a form of superstition.
All righty. Rebecca Lynn, lots of questions there. Thank you for those. This one comes from Daco Taco. Do gingers have souls?
Well, yeah, unless they become a member of the undead, sure. I'm a ginger. I'm alive. I have a soul. So gingers have souls unless they become a member of the undead.
All right, Daco Taco, I hope that was satisfying to you. They might need more anesthesia, though. Have you ever heard of that, Jimmy?
Oh, yeah. I've had doctors tell me that one of the reasons I process anesthetics so rapidly is because of my ginger genetics.
Yeah. I have a daughter like that. She surprises them how much she needs. Isaiah asks this. Well, he starts with, hi, Jimmy. I was recently reading 1 Corinthians, and I noticed something in chapter 5 that I had seen before, but it made me think about you because it seemed possibly paranormal. Come on, Cyril. In chapter 5, verses 3 through 5, Paul said, for though absent in body, I am present in spirit, and as if present, I have already pronounced judgment in the name of the Lord Jesus on the man who has done such a thing. When you are assembled and my spirit is present with the power of our Lord Jesus, you are to deliver this man to Satan. This kind of reminds me of the caught up to the third heaven phrase that Paul used. The part that really got me thinking is him saying, and my spirit is present. He doesn't seem to be describing bilocation because he is not talking about being bodily present with them. I thought that would have been really cool though too. But do you think he is speaking in metaphor about his spirit being present? Or do you think he was actually seeing through an angel or vision or some other supernatural revelation from God? The more I think about this, the more curious I find myself.
So I think that one of the keys to understanding this is to ask what the Corinthians would have experienced. Because even if Paul was having a vision of what's going on in their church service, how do they know that? You know, they gather together in church and they're supposed to turn this guy over to Satan. But if they're supposed to wait for the Apostle Paul to have a vision of their service, how are they going to ever know if he's having one? That doesn't seem to be plausible. So I think a more natural interpretation is Paul is speaking metaphorically here. He's not anticipating that he's going to have a clairvoyant vision of what's going on in their service at a distance. Instead, he's thinking, I'm present with you in spirit the same way today we might say so-and-so couldn't come to our meeting, but he's present here in spirit, meaning he is aware that we're meeting and he is supporting our meeting and stuff like that. And he'd be here if he could. So I think that metaphor is in play here. There's a question, though, about whether there's something else in play. Some recent commentators have noted that there's an ambiguity between spirit understood in the human sense and the Holy Spirit. And Paul may be playing on that fact, meaning when I am present in my spirit and the Holy Spirit is present in power, turn this man over to Satan.
All righty. Thanks. Who was that now? That was Isaiah. Thank you, Isaiah, very much. Thanks to everybody who sent in their questions. We could have gone on for another hour. There's more of these, and you are welcome to get your weird questions to us. We'll do it next time. Jimmy, thanks. Enjoyed the 2 hours with you.
Me too. My pleasure.
All right, that'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.